So what has Disney taught us over the years? Do not judge a book by its cover. Underneath every beast is Fabio, right? Oh, underneath everyone is a handsome prince or a beautiful princess. Anyone not familiar with that was done in 1990, it was released. We were just talking about it, it felt like the other day. So anyways, that's the Disney version of Beauty and the Beast. Powerful story told in Disney way that you should never judge another person. Because that's what television tells us, right? Underneath the male pattern baldness is a handsome prince. Perfect skin of the woman is a beautiful princess. We can't judge anyone because inside they might be beautiful. Or at least they might possibly be beautiful. Because this is kind of how our society started to function. I remember one time I was in university and someone just judged the crap out of me for something completely innocent. I was volunteering for a school for kids in juvie in a really rough area of Edmonton. And so I'd taken the train there because you didn't really leave your car in that area. So I'm walking across the parking lot because I'm introverted, my head's down and I'm looking at where I'm going. And all of a sudden I see feet in front of me, so I kind of stop. And I look up and up and up and up into three very large, very angry native gentlemen. And the guy in the middle is just like, "Are you an effing skinhead?" Even back then, I shaved my head. And I didn't want to tell him that I have this crazy white guy afro and I shave it off just to like make sure it doesn't take over the world. I didn't even think about that. The first thing that popped into my head was just a blatant lie. Like, I said, "No, I'm not a skinhead. I'm a competitive swimmer. I can go faster this way." And the guy's like, "Oh, hey, no worries, man. Yeah, have a good day. Yeah, see ya." Oh, my goodness. Total lie. I can't even float. Never mind swim. So, do I like being judged by something on the outside? No. Am I a skinhead? No. Am I proud of lying to three large native gentlemen? It got me out of a beating, so I'm not sure where I'm going. I don't like it when someone judges me about something and assumes 100 other things from one little thing. Do you? You want to be judged based on your ethnicity? Or you're a white male? Therefore, you must be misogynist, anti-feminist, love sports, drink beer, blah, blah, blah. Your gender? You're a woman, therefore. Sexual orientation? You're straight, therefore. You're gay, therefore. How do you feel when someone judges your life choices? You got a divorce. You went to school for something. You took a job with. You asked these questions. How about your spiritual life? If you tell the world you're a Christian, what do they assume about you? You're judgmental, anti-science, anti-same-sex marriage, anti. How did you feel the last time someone judged you? Often we say we love to come to church on Sundays because we love to be around like-minded people. Translation, people like us so they don't judge us. We have support groups for like people so we don't get judged. At the core of our society is, I think, this ethos of not judging each other. People have often said we love Jesus but we hate Christians. I think what they're saying is Jesus didn't judge, but you guys do. Jesus accepted. He loved everyone, stuck up for everyone, no matter what they did or who they were. So Jesus seemed on this non-judgmental bandwagon, right? Just in case you don't spend all week studying the Bible like I do, I thought I'd give you a quick overview of what Jesus did say. No wonder we like Jesus, huh? Seems to like people, not judge people. I learned it this way. Jesus said, "Judge not lest thee be judged." I learned it so long ago, I know it in Middle English. The heart of our society is this idea that you don't judge each other. And it seems that the heart of Jesus' worldview is you don't judge each other. So how in the world could Paul, another author in the Bible, say, you aren't being judgmental enough? It's So we got Jesus on this hand saying, judge not lest ye be judged. And Paul saying, no, judge more. And like, kick him out of the church once you've judged him. How do we deal with that kind of a disagreement in the Bible? Do we follow Jesus and ignore Paul like many have done for the last little while? Do we throw Jesus out and follow Paul, which seems weird? We're not Christians. I don't. When I say judge, I don't mean just in your mind, like making a decision. I mean judging the person's a sinner and kicking them out of the church. Like, I'm talking excommunication here. So today I'm going to try and reconcile these two pieces. This concept of Jesus saying not to judge. I want to ask the question, what does Paul really mean when he says we're not being judgmental enough? So, this is the third Sunday in our series of stories behind the words of Paul. Now, Paul is one of the most prolific writers in the New Testament. And unfortunately, his words have been used to cause much damage in the last 2,000 years. Churches have been split over his passages. People have been torn from their communities. We did this series because often there's a story behind the words that makes sense of them. That on their own, they don't really make sense. We can apply them really easily all over different places. But when you understand the story behind the words, sometimes it's a little clearer. And before we move any further into discussing this passage today, there's two very important pieces. So this is where all my schooling gets to talk about this one little thing. I get really excited when I get to talk about this stuff. First, Paul has not written this letter to us. He says it at the beginning of the book. He's written this letter to the church in Corinth. And he says that in his opening greetings. He doesn't have us in view. Paul does not have the last 2,000 years in view. Paul's speaking to a church sometime in the first century AD. Now, some of you might have the view of the Bible that says it was written for a universal audience. And that's completely okay. That might be in the case. But at Friend Church here, we use this premise when we speak about the Bible. We say we value the Bible as literature that bears witness to God's interaction with humanity. We don't assume that the letter to the church in Corinth was focused on us. We believe it was focused on them. It was meant for them. It applied to them. So not to say we can't learn from it. And I hope we will today. It's just to say we don't assume that this letter is focused on us. So second, for those of you who don't know, there's the first letter to the church in Corinth and there's the second letter to the church in Corinth in your Bible. But the problem is, we know there's at least three other letters that we have no record of. At least one of them Paul wrote, possibly more. There's a bunch of letters that the church in Corinth wrote to Paul, and then he would write back, and then they'd write him back again. Then he'd write back, and that's the letter we have. So often it feels like when you're reading the letters to Paul, it feels kind of like you're missing something. And it's because you're missing a lot. I was originally going to call this series What Happens in Corinth Stays in Corinth, but I thought maybe that was a bit too tongue-in-cheek. So there's tons of context that we just have no clue. And the reason that's important is for this reason. So we read the text, and Paul comes across really angry. Really like, just give it to him. And if that's the first letter, if you ask a question and someone basically tears your head off in the first answer, you assume that the question you asked is probably a big deal, right? But if this has happened time and time again where you say, hey, can I do this? No. Really, can I do this? We're doing it anyways. We're going to ignore you. But can we do this? No. No, seriously, we're still doing it. We're ignoring you completely. We want your permission. He's like, no. He's not mad at the question. He's mad at them ignoring him for the last however many letters. He's like, why am I even writing these letters to you people? So it's important to understand that we're missing a bunch of the story. It's like watching the highlight reel of the game, but you never actually got to see the game. So it's important to realize this isn't written to us. And there's a ton of stuff that we just have no clue about because we're missing a bunch of the documents. But I still think we can learn from this thing. So let me show you what I'm going to do today. So what's this passage that's caused all the problems for the last however many thousands of years? It's this. You must throw this sexually immoral man out of the church and hand him over to Satan so his sinful nature will be destroyed and he himself will be saved on the day the Lord returns. You must throw him out of the church.
You must judge the man to be bad. You must kick him out of his church, away from his community, away from his friends, away from the place he connects with God, out of his spiritual gym. I want him out of the door. No longer part of you. You must judge this man. It's kind of harsh, isn't it? Imagine if one of you came up here and started looking through my life and found a bunch of garbage in there and said, yeah, Vince, you're out. If someone did that to you, it's not going to feel good. It's kind of brutal, actually. So I want to look at this a little bit more carefully because I want you to understand that the basis of or this verse has caused or been the basis for many people getting kicked out of the church. In the past, you were divorced. You didn't give 10% of your money to the church. Gay, lesbian, rich, alcoholic, convicted felon, sex before you're married, too good looking. The list goes on and on and on. It was thought that a good looking person would engage in sex outside of marriage and therefore they were considered bad people. It's brutal, isn't it? Even in Friends Church past, and I'm absolutely embarrassed to talk about this, but when Friend Church first started, we engaged in this. We judged people and we asked them to leave. It's a dark part of our history that we still look at with regret. But let me be clear. This Friend Church of old, like other churches, has used this verse as justification for literally excommunicating people from our communities. Away from people's way of connecting with God. Away from like-minded people that weren't supposed to judge them. When I read this list, and I think about you, I know a lot of your stories. I know some of you have been kicked out of communities based on this verse. It's been unbelievably painful. But hurtful, it's confusing. So if this is all done in the name of Paul, we better have this pretty figured out, don't we? If we think that we should kick people out of our churches, we should judge them based on this letter from Paul, we better understand exactly what he's talking about. So let me tell you the story behind this verse, as best as I can recreate it. So, what do you imagine Paul, the writer in the Bible, looks like? And you have a visual image in your head? I kind of have this, like, guy who's like, you know, tall and handsome, curly hair, not like my afro, but like, you know, well coiffed hair with a band maybe holding it back. He's got one of those toga robes with the thing over his arm. You know, King David, King Solomon, like, this is the kind of guy. He walks in the room, everyone's like, whoa, check that guy out. And everything he says is just like magic. He's got a voice like Grant Pollock, and he's just like silky smooth fez. It's just beautiful. It's charismatic, right? Walks in the room and everyone's just like, whoa, I want to listen to you. It's not at all what he looks like. As far as we know, from the records we can gather, this letter to the church in Corinth was written from a little city called Ephesus across the Aegean Sea by a small man, probably middle-aged, balding, bow-legged, gnarly feet, protruding knees. He can't see very well, so he kind of looks at you like a mouse. Tradition says he has a monobrow and a big nose. And on most days, you'd find him sitting in a little shop someplace that he's rented, hunched over some animal skins, making a tent. You know, you picture him like in this ivory tower, penning these beautiful words, right? No, he's sitting there making a tent because that's how he makes his living. That's how he pays to go from city to city to city. And he's sitting there one day, and he hears a noise. And because he's half blind, he can't really tell. So he's kind of like, he can tell there's a shadow there. So he kind of walks really close to the guy and suddenly realizes it's a friend of a friend from the church in Corinth. So he's like, oh, yeah, come in. Sit down. I don't know if they drink a beer or have a tea. I don't know what they did back then. But they do something sociable. And the guy from Corinth starts to tell him this story. Or at least this is my best recreation of it. There's a man, let's call him Alexander. He's a young man, sitting at a separate table at his father's home. the height of his strength, not wearied by age or life. We'd call him virile. This guy's hot. And one day he's having supper with his family, all cocky and macho, you know, giving the guns to people. When he notices Hypatia, his stepmom, kind of looking at him under her eyelashes. Not sure what to do with that. He's kind of like... And she's young because his mom's older. And Hypatia was married to his dad, his second wife. She's quite good looking. Like, maybe not beautiful, but, you know, girl next door good looking. But she's loaded. Her family is like loaded, like old world money loaded. And in Greco-Roman culture, when you married and you were loaded, some of that money went to your husband. And it's not until a few months later, after Alexander's father dies, and Alexander becomes the man of the house, that he starts to contemplate exactly what will life look like without Hypatia's money. How exactly is he going to run a household? Hire servants, buy new clothes, go drinking with his buddies. Without Hypatia's money, that all goes away. In fact, he's going to have to get a job. Like, make money the old-fashioned way. And he's going, oh no, that's not cool at all. And then, as young men do, he starts to think back through his life. And he remembers that day Hypatia, his stepmom, looks at him from underneath her eyelashes at the table. A look that maybe isn't appropriate between stepmother and stepson. And from that he hatches a plan. A plan of seduction that would ultimately lead to his wealth restored. To the life that he'd been accustomed to, assured. And it started with a seduction and ultimate relationship with his stepmother. Something that contravened Paul's moral code. For sure. He is not happy about this. Sexual relations with your stepmother was considered morally reprehensible and completely against Jewish law as well. The book of Deuteronomy says this, a man shall not marry his father's wife, thereby violating his father's rights. It was even considered immoral for the Romans, and these guys were anything goes kind of people. Like, anything goes. But you didn't marry a stepmom. So on that day, it was considered immoral and illegal by pretty much everybody. It was wrong no matter how you looked at it. And the church in Corinth, of which Alexander was most likely an active member, was most likely an influential member, probably a huge financial contributor, the church in Corinth was boasting that Alexander was welcome in their midst. He's part of the community. He's one of us. And the worst part of the problem is, the story tells us that Paul has addressed this situation with them time and time again, and they're completely ignoring him. And so Paul loses it. He's furious. Paul's response is the one we find captured. It says, kick that immoral, incestual, greedy lawbreaker out of your community. I told you this before and you didn't do it. Now kick him out now. Now I want to be clear here. And this is where I think history has misused this passage. The context of judgment here isn't small. It's not an accident. It's not immoral, a little immoral thing. It's illegal, immoral at the highest levels. So don't think someone who drinks a little too much and needs a cab ride home is what Paul's talking about here. He's talking about somebody who is deliberately and regularly getting smashed, hammered beyond all functionality, and then choosing to drive home. On a consistent basis. That's the scale of what he's talking about here. We're talking a lifetime of moral bankruptcy and complete disregard for the laws and morality of any kind. Like someone you might know who has a life-threatening sexual disease, but insists on sleeping unprotected with partners and not telling them. I don't think Paul has in mind here someone getting caught shoplifting. I think he has in mind inviting the Bernie Madoffs of this world to be part of our community while they're conducting their Ponzi schemes. So don't think mistakes. Don't think small issues. Don't think one-offs. These people are flagrantly living a life in contravention to all moral and legal standards. I think these are the people Paul's talking to about here. People like Alexander, from the church in Corinth. So how does it make you feel to be called to judge someone? Kind of makes me a little uncomfortable. In building this message, I kept wanting to add things like, well, they're hurting another person, and therefore it's okay to judge them, right? But that's our society talking, not the text. Even considering that I have the power to judge somebody makes me uncomfortable. It's much easier to accept everyone, isn't it? But we do judge. When Jesus says, don't judge, we agree to a point, but at a certain point, we probably would judge, wouldn't we? We'd let a person be a part of our community if they made mistakes. If that person was still making mistakes, we'd probably still let them be part of our community. And what if those mistakes were hurting somebody? What if it was hurting them? Would we kick them out of our church? What if those mistakes are hurting somebody else? And what if that person that they're hurting is a child? And what if after we talk to them and say, hey, that's not cool, they're unrepentant and say, no, it's my right to do this to that child. It starts getting a little bit fuzzy, doesn't it? Would we judge them? Would we ask them to leave? And if what they were doing to that child wasn't just hurting them emotionally, what if it was hurting them physically or sexually? Over the last however many years, many clergy have been accused of abusing children. It's not only Catholic, it's Protestant as well. Should they be allowed access to children? Should they be allowed access to our churches? At some point, and I'm not sure if I hit your point, but at some point, almost everyone will say, that's okay to judge. That now crossed my line. We might even say it's for the safety of our community, might be for the health of the person. And it would be hard, but at some point, we'd probably all agree that judgment needs to be done. A decision needs to be made. A consequence needs to be felt. And honestly, I don't think that's bad. I, like Paul, think at a certain point, judgment needs to be made. And it's well within the realm of possibility that somebody will need to be asked to leave the community. But the question becomes, when? When should you judge? And when should that judgment render a verdict of excommunication? I think the story behind the words of Paul this week show us that judgment is a rare thing. It only ever happens in something huge, like huge. And even then, it's not simple. It's not just saying if someone does this, if this is the line, they cross that, they're out, it's no big deal. It's almost like the bigger, more complex the issue gets, the more difficult it is to judge. Situations like the ones Paul's talking about here, I believe, are complex in the same way. There's usually so much more to the situation than we understand. So my thoughts after studying this for the last while is this. If you hit one of these situations in your life, realize it's a rare thing. And most likely, if it's that big, it's probably complex. Don't feel like you have to render a verdict. Don't feel like you have to judge. You may think deeply about the situation and go, you know what? No. The answer here is love. If you hit one of these huge situations, don't feel like you need to do it alone. Think deeply about it. Bring other people in to help you think deeply about it. Treat this situation with the gravity that it deserves. Take your time. Hold in your head the health of the person and the health of the community, because to ask somebody to leave a community is a huge deal that has grave ramifications for years to come. I know it's difficult, but sometimes to protect a group of people or even another person, someone will be asked to be removed. Honestly, I've never had to do it. I've never even come close to thinking I needed to do it. I never thought it was appropriate. But after studying this for the last 2 weeks, I feel better prepared that if it ever comes to one of those situations, I'll know how to handle it. So the lesson I want to leave you with is this. Let's realize that we're not called by Paul to judge everyone around us. We don't have a license to kick people out of our community willy-nilly for whatever we want.
The only situations that even warrant this discussion are huge issues that cross moral and legal boundaries. If we ever come upon one of these situations, let's give it the care it deserves. Let's not judge too quickly or too rashly. Let's contemplate deeply while holding the good of the community and the good of the person in mind. Can we do that? Before I go, I want to give you guys a homework assignment. I want to encourage you this afternoon, maybe for lunch, or if you come to the pub, come chat with us. I want you to discuss in a friendly way what things you think warrant judgment. And I want you to listen to what the other people have to say, because sometimes they will bring up points that you never thought about. You thought it was an easy issue, black and white, until they say, oh, what about this? And vice versa. They might challenge your thinking, you might challenge theirs. And in so doing, I think we will be able to think deeply if these situations ever come up. So, that's your homework. It's a bit quiet today, but it kind of warrants that solemn reflection. So, have a great week. Come back next week. I'm going to be doing a study of homosexuality in Paul's writings. So if you've ever stayed on one side of the issue or the other, you got to see this one because it has been a fantastic study. So I encourage you to come back next week. Have a great week. We'll see you at 4:30 at the pub.